The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What did your wife, Bonnie, mean when she told you she had gluten neck?
She meant that the practitioners who were working on her at the retreat she went to with her friends told her that her upper body, particularly her neck, was so inflamed that they really were concerned about even trying to work on it. And they thought that the culprit in all of this was the gluten protein in wheat, rye, or barley.
This is The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. Glad to have you with us. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Stephen Yaffa about his book that might help you make some sense of all the hoopla about gluten. It's titled Grain of Truth, The Real Case For and Against Wheat and Gluten. In the first pages of your book, you describe what happened after Bonnie's decision to stop eating gluten of all kinds, and I'd like you to read a short passage from the prologue.
Sure. This also explains how I wound up writing this book. As an investigative journalist, wheat and gluten weren't necessarily high on the agenda for me, but because of this personal situation that developed, they soon became a focus of interest, and I think this explains why. One of the many bonds between my wife Bonnie and myself has long been the sturdy armor of skepticism we have both erected to protect ourselves from the relentless onslaught of dietary, fashion, lifestyle, and spiritual fads, all directed toward creating a slimmer, bouncier, brighter-eyed, whiter-toothed, higher-functioning you and me. Just the sort of evolved being we've both learned to dodge at cocktail parties. Over 2 decades, we lived through the Atkins, Pritikin, Scarsdale, South Beach, Blood Type, Beverly Hills, Detox, Israeli Army, Cabbage Soup, and Grapefruit diets and emerged more or less intact. We survived everything from breakdancing and lava lamps to Tony Robbins. There have been scars, but no damage to the major organs, including the cerebral cortex, or so I thought. Then came the Ayurvedic retreat. Bonnie and 3 female friends disappeared into the hills near Calistoga in Napa County one December morning for a weekend of intense spa treatments. Returning home, my wife made an announcement. "I have a gluten neck," she said. Her first words, I waited for the punchline. None followed. Apparently, 2 male Ayurvedic practitioners who work on you as a team, I know how this sounds, performed their tandem bodywork on Bonnie. One of the body workers dug his knuckles into the kinks in my neck and shoulders, and after a minute he just stopped, Bonnie reported. He told me, "There's very little I can do for you until you stop eating gluten. Your upper body is so inflamed that if you sincerely want to see change, you'll have to take gluten out of your diet." "And I am," she said, "starting now." That was not the punchline I expected. The first items to disappear from my kitchen pantry were pumpernickel, crusty sourdough with its spongy interior, and every other form of wheat-based, chewy, delicious bread and bagel. In their place, a whole cast of pretenders moved in like squatters, bearing no resemblance to the authentic original, loaves baking to be called bread, yet made from tapioca rice, sorghum, potato, cornstarch, and flour I had never heard of. The cookies and crackers and other assorted dry, brittle, wannabe edibles that I snipped off with my front tooth, like slivers of seasoned cardboard, dismayed me, and I attempted to crunch them into bite-sized units capable of being swallowed. Whether eating non-gluten pizza, pasta, or pastry, the experience of savoring and chewing anything springy and doughing soon became a nostalgic memory at best, the way the bright sun glows only in the recollections of characters in bleak post-apocalyptic novels. Nothing remained of the heady scent, elasticity, and buoyant texture I associated with leavened wheat. What I'm eating isn't food, I decided. It is punishment for running the occasional red light and sins I've yet to commit.
So, in case people don't know, what exactly is gluten?
That's a very good question. And by the way, a lot of people don't know. There's a classic Jimmy Kimmel interview on the street from a year or two ago, in which a lot of young people who have sworn off gluten and pronounced themselves gluten-free are asked in front of a gym in L.A., what is gluten? And actually, not one of them has a clue what gluten is, even though they've decided that they're fundamentally never going to touch it again. The answer to your question is that gluten is a package of two proteins in starch, in wheat, barley, and rye. Those two proteins are gliadin and glutenin. They account for the elasticity and the extensibility of dough, so that when dough rises in the oven, that's what makes it rise, which is the gluten molecule of proteins in the dough. And they together combine to capture escaping carbon dioxide and create the air pockets that give bread its wonderful airy quality when you eat it.
So obviously the people who don't know what gluten is have a gluten sensitivity, not total gluten intolerance. So explain the difference between those two.
Yes, and by the way, they may not have a gluten sensitivity either, but we'll get into that later. The essential difference is this. Gluten intolerance is celiac disease. Celiac disease really affects less than 1% of us, or close to 1% of us. And any form of gluten, and gluten's in a lot of products these days because it's a binding agent as well, any amount of gluten beyond 20 parts per million sets up an autoimmune reaction in the body, which really is friendly fire when your body attacks itself, and all sorts of really awful things can potentially happen. It also destroys the lining of the intestine and collapses the little fingers along the intestine, finger-like structures that absorb nutrients and pass them along into the bloodstream, so that if you have celiac disease, among many other things, you're going to be extremely malnourished. That's gluten intolerance. And it can be very well established through blood tests and even biopsies if it goes to that stage. There's no mistaking it, because it elevates things called epitodes in the system, and it's easily diagnosable. On the other hand, gluten sensitivity still can't really be definitively diagnosed through blood work or anything else. And so almost all of the literature on this right now and the studies have to do with self-reported symptoms. Since there's no definitive diagnosis that shows up in blood work, it becomes a question of people who seem to have common symptoms and reactions to gluten, and gathering all those statistics. A University of Maryland study of about 3,000 or 4,000 people a few years back determined that about 6% of us at most may have gluten sensitivity. But a guy in Australia who's done a lot of work on this thinks it's much less, thinks it's less than 0.5%. So you can see, in spite of all of the hoopla about gluten and the $15 billion industry that's emerged, it's still very uncertain in terms of scientific evidence.
Some of this gluten sensitivity hype has come from popular books, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes. But first, let's go back. When you decided that you were going to research this, and you admit that you're an obsessive person, you spent 18 months looking for answers about wheat and doing research, and you traveled thousands of miles and interviewed more than 100 people. So tell us what you found out about why white flour became and remains so popular. Even though it's not good for us, we still eat it. Why is that?
White flour is the most utilitarian of foods in many ways, because it has no character of its own. What it does is sort of a supporting actor. You know, you fry foods by dipping them in it, and on it goes. You make breads and all that stuff, but you're really not looking for flavor. You're looking for other properties as well. And historically, white flour, which has always been the most difficult to separate from the bran and the germ in a wheat seed, has always been the flour that has been most favored. And it wasn't really until the end of the 19th century that milling technique called roller milling came along. And finally, it took white flour from being an aristocratic foodstuff to being something that the middle class could suddenly afford. And the word refined really simply means that it's been stripped. And in this case, it's been stripped of all the vitamins and nutrients that really are crucial in a wheat seed for us to be healthy. And that refined white flour, which is filled with starch that converts very quickly to sugar and shoots into our bloodstream, very much like drinking a soda, that white flour became extraordinarily popular. So popular, in fact, that by World War II, it was determined that 40 or 50% of the recruits flunked the physical, and nobody for a while knew why. And the reason that they flunked it was that these were kids who were brought up on huge amounts of Wonder Bread and other kinds of white breads. And that dough they were eating, basically baked dough, had absolutely no nutritive value whatsoever. And it was only after World War II that legislation was passed to enrich, as they call it, a white flour, which is really what's going on today, by spraying vitamins and minerals back at the end of the process and from exterior sources, and not all of the ones that are really in the actual wheat seed.
The end of World War II was a long time ago, and yet we're still consuming huge quantities of white flour.
Absolutely. Everybody eats white flour whether they want to or not, pretty much, unless they're celiacs, because it's in so many different things. You know, you go to a restaurant, you pick up a piece of bread from the bread basket, and it's got white flour in it. And white flour basically is not going to kill anybody overnight or do anything like that. It's a question of what you blend it with if you're making bread. If you're merely making whole wheat, 100% whole wheat bread, or you're making bread that's primarily whole wheat, and you're adding, as bakers often do, a certain amount of white flour to that mix because it really has very good performance properties. The gluten in it works very well for bakers. You know, you're doing it consciously, and you're managing to create a product that still has vitamins and minerals in it that naturally. And I think we're going to go on eating white flour one form or another. And certainly wheat is not the only source of white flour. It comes from all sorts of other products as well, but it's really the only one that lends itself to the properties that are needed for baking.
There's so much in the wheat bran and the wheat germ that gets taken out and then, shockingly, fed to animals. We're not really being nourished, even though the vitamins are sprayed back on.
No, that's exactly right. And there's another problem, too. I've been to industrial bakeries. As anybody reads my book will get a pretty good close-up view of industrial bakeries and industrial mills like Conagra and General Mills, the big ones in this country, who do an amazingly efficient job, by the way. However, there is a price to pay for some of that. And one of them, as you just mentioned, is that in these massive mills, what happens is that all of the nutrients and vitamins get shipped off for animals. And what we're left with is white flour that essentially, as I've mentioned, is really not a nutritive food. And the other problem, which is perhaps equally or more serious, is that the whole process of baking from beginning to end, meaning through fermentation, takes less than 4 hours. And in 4 hours, you give gluten no chance to be naturally broken down, and you give none of the vitamins and minerals really an opportunity to sort of work comfortably with the white flour, so that the end product has a kind of chewiness and consistency that we really love in breads. I think all of us, one way or another, has probably eaten an artisan loaf of bread that's been locally made sooner or later. And when we have, we know the difference between that and the packaged breads that are on the shelf of supermarkets. And the short processing time I found to be equally crucial in terms of denying us the pleasure of bread and really creating for many people a problem with gluten that they might not otherwise have.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Stephen Yaffa about his book, Grain of Truth, The Real Case For and Against Wheat and Gluten. You can hear this program again or share it with a friend from our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link there to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll be back after a short break to find out what Stephen Yaffa thinks about popular books like Grain Brain and Wheat Belly. Don't go away. Disagree with certain statements made in popular books like Wheat Belly and Grain Brain. Explain why.
I not only disagree with them, I think they're doing us a huge disservice. William Davis in Wheat Belly tells us that wheat has killed more people than all wars combined. David Perlmutter in Grain Brain tells us that eating wheat, any whole grain really, is like pouring kerosene over your head and igniting it with a match. These are two physicians, and both of them respected in their own fields, neither of which has to do with nutrition, by the way. But when they start promulgating their theories like this and proselytizing, they're scaring the heck out of a lot of people unnecessarily. The truth of the matter is that whole grains are extraordinarily healthful for 99% of us, or certainly in the 90s somewhere, not in the 30s or 40s. For almost all of us, whole grains are essential. They prolong life, as a Harvard study earlier this year determined, and they cut way down on cardio issues that many people have, and they have a whole bunch of other benefits as well. But to dismiss them and put them in the same category as refined white flour is really a disservice to us all, and these guys know better.
If I'm remembering what you wrote correctly, enzymes and certain other bacteria and things that are present in the grain, they're dismissing all of that as well.
Yes, they are. And in fact, they're robbing us by, if anybody follows them too closely, which a lot of people do, over 100 million people these days are avoiding things with gluten in them in the United States, or claiming to. But when you do that, what you're doing is really depriving yourself of a very important source of fiber. And you're not really paying attention to, the natural process is that is very beneficial for you. Because when you naturally ferment any grain, let's just stay with wheat for the moment. When you naturally ferment wheat, you're talking about doing it over 2 days. That's long fermentation. And that whole process creates enormously beneficial probiotic activities in the gut. The lactoacid bacteria in sourdough is extremely beneficial for our gut, and on it goes from there. And so what you've done is deprive yourself, if you're not allowing yourself to eat these products, really, in whole, ideally organic form. So it's not theoretical. It really has to do with what your system wants, and your system really knows, and everybody is different. So I'm very wary about making the kind of, incredibly broad statements that Davis and Perlmutter make. I think you really have to pay attention. Some people are extremely sensitive to gluten, a small amount of people probably. And if that's true, then they shouldn't eat it at all, even if they don't have celiac disease. But for the great bulk of us, that probably is not true. And my pitch really is to go out and support your local grain economy. And there will be one, because there are a lot of local grains being grown now and milled, stone milled, and baked in a long fermentation process around where you live. And it's worth, hunting out these grains, because they're extremely beneficial. And by the way, they taste delicious.
Oh, yes, they do. And there is a lot of that information in your book. I want to talk about the bacteria, though, because this surprised me. You say in your book that the gut's bacteria total 2 to 3 pounds of your body weight. That's astounding. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure, it does. In fact, I found this out. There are 100 trillion microflora in your gut. 100 trillion is a lot. That is why the gut, no, it's not why, but one of the reasons the gut is called the second brain, because in the research that's been going on, particularly in the last 5 years or so, the gut turns out to play a more and more important role and in our general health. In fact, all diseases begin in the gut, which is interesting. And the serotonin that we think of as being, determining mood in our brain and so forth, most of it's actually manufactured in the gut and goes up the vagus nerve to our brain. So when you start looking at this more closely, you see that not only is there a huge amount of microflora in the gut, but it also has a hugely important part in the way that we function. That's why you really want to feed it what it loves. And what it loves mostly is organic fiber.
And so this long fermentation process that you're talking about that the commercial bread industry has totally ignored, that is ruining all of these bacteria.
Yes, the short version allows your bacteria to enjoy none of the benefits of whole grains, or very few of them at most. And I think it's really incumbent upon the large cereal companies in this country to pay attention to the fact that they're delivering a lot of non-nutritious wheat and grain products to us, which is fine if you want to give people a choice. You know, I'm not suggesting that we ban them by any means. I'm suggesting that what we do is create a bread that is long fermentation bread, legitimately a sourdough bread that may cost a dollar or so more, but is still within the budget of people who are trying to feed a large family or anybody who's just trying to, you know, get by. That does not exist. You can go through endless amounts of shelves in supermarkets around this country. Anything that's marked sourdough and is in a package is really artificially sourdough bread. It's been sprayed with some kind of an acidic compound at the end of the process, vinegar or whatever it might be, acetic acid, and it's claiming that it's sourdough. But sourdough has nothing to do with that. Sourdough has to do with the long fermentation process that creates the lactic acid bacteria that benefits your gut. And that's a very different kind of sourdough.
And you discovered all this by not only talking to people, but you started making bread.
Yes, I started making bread. I've been a winemaker in the past, and so I've always been a hands-on person. And one of the things about sourdough is when you start making it at home, it becomes a really kind of wonderful exercise if you happen to want to do it. It always sounds a little more complicated than it is at first because you have to make a starter, which is really nothing more than flour and water, but you have to be observant for a week or so and feed it, as they say, meaning add more of both and so forth. But once you get the starter going, it's really the engine that drives the train. And so basically what you're doing with when you make sourdough is taking a certain amount of that starter, adding more flour, water, and whatever else you want to add, salt, you know, and some people like rosemary and olives and walnuts. You can throw anything in there that you really like. But you're starting to make a bread that sits overnight from the first stage when you make the levain, and then you bake the next day or the day after or whatever. So it's a long process in terms of time, but your actual time in doing it is probably 30 to 40 minutes max. So, you know, it's not intimidating once you do it. And then you get this great bread that lasts for over a week because it's got lactic acid bacteria in it and a very particular kind of yeast that doesn't deteriorate, so it stays fresh.
Now, you've been doing this for a while, so to you, making a starter probably seems like an easy thing. But if somebody's intimidated by that, I saw some online sources as well.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. The short version of the answer is go to King Arthur Flour on the web and look up sourdough. And they have a sourdough starter that's already begun. It comes in a jar, and it cuts down the process probably by halftime. And there's certainly others out there as well. I'm not suggesting they're the only one. But yeah, if you really want to get a jump on this, that's what I would suggest. You know, you basically are getting something that the instructions are clear. And in a couple of days, you'll start having this bubbling vat, that which is really the starter, and go from there.
And what about people who have no interest in baking bread?
That's most of us, by the way, and most of us can find delicious local sourdoughs by going to artisan bakers and talking to the baker and saying, you know, what do you got in the sourdough world? And by the way, you know, they're going to talk to you about a lot of customers they have who tell them they have gluten sensitivity, but once they start eating sourdough, they find that they actually can tolerate it pretty well. I'm not talking about celiacs, by the way. I'm talking about people with sensitivity only. And part of the reason for that has to do with the fact that the sourdough process scissors through these bulky gluten molecules, makes them much easier to digest so that they break down into small chains of amino acids called peptides, and your system has no problem with them by and large unless you're particularly sensitive.
I really like your book because you have all of the scientific information, but you write it in a way that didn't make my eyes glaze over maybe once or twice.
You know, when I read things too, if I find my eyes are glazing over, then the author hasn't necessarily really captured my interest too much. And so when I write, and there is a certain amount of science in this, you know, I first have to untangle it for myself and run it by somebody who's an authority if I have a question. And then I've got to be able to transmit it in a way that I would actually, you know, like to read. And that's part of the challenge and part of the fun of doing the writing.
So you wrote about Bonnie's decision to, at the end of the book, to try eating your homemade sourdough bread. And tell us what happened.
Okay, so I'm making my sourdough bread, and I have no interest in trying to change her diet. She'll figure out what she wants to do at her own time and in her own way. Meanwhile, I start making my sourdough bread. And, of course, when you make bread at home, you know, the scent fills the house from the oven. So she'd walk through the kitchen and see me making bread and smell it. You know, it was getting harder and harder for her to resist. And her, meanwhile, you know, her neck was not changing one way or another. So one day she picks up a slice about 6 months into her non-gluten diet. She picks up a slice of bread that I made that morning. It's still slightly warm. And she bites into it. And I kind of didn't say anything. I looked at her and she looked up at me. And as I describe it in my book, she was like a prisoner who just got out after years incarceration and saw the sun for the first time. She said, "Stephen, this is bread," you know, and that pretty much did it for her. And so she started eating my sourdough regularly, as I do. And she never had any issues at all in terms of gluten based on eating my bread. In fact, there are many myths about gluten. One of them is that you gain weight. Another is that it's unhealthy, meaning that if you're non-gluten, you'll lose weight and you basically will be healthier. But neither one of these turns out to be true, by the way. And she wound up actually losing weight, as I did, by eating my bread every day, which is kind of an interesting little bit of a side note on this.
It was one that she attributed to not snacking so much.
Exactly. And it's true because when you eat, you know, I make mostly whole wheat bread, meaning that about 70%, no matter what else I'm putting in there, rye flour or whatever, is 100% whole organic wheat. And it turns out to be extremely filling in a good way. You know, it's not bloating at all, but it's filling. And so she and I are basically snackers just by temperament. You know, we're grazers, but we stopped grazing. And I didn't realize it until she said, "You're looking thin." That's sort of how this started. And I stepped on the scale and I realized I'd lost 10 pounds eating two or three pieces of my bread every day. So make of that what you will, but it's definitely true. In fact, she said, you know, that when she lost the 5 pounds eating my bread, it was the final 5 pounds that most women are always trying to lose. So my recipe for this book in the back with a picture of Bonnie and myself is called The Final Five Sourdough.
It's a great picture. I'm going to go find me some sourdough starter.
or find somebody who really loves to make it and then just befriend them.
Stephen Yaffa and his wife Bonnie live in Mill Valley, California. If you have an experience with wheat or gluten that you'd like to share with Stephen Yaffa, look for a link to his contact information at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, book excerpts and reviews, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.